Well, thank you very much for that introduction and for inviting me here this evening. What I was going to do was to deal with the antibody revolution. There's considerable interest at the moment in the translation of scientific research and invention, you know, avoiding the valley of death and building UK industry and jobs. And I'm going to talk about an area, therapeutic antibodies, that's revolutionising and disrupting the pharmaceutical industry. It's grown in the last 20 years to an industry worth nearly $50 billion a year. And UK science and translational activities have played a major role in its development. Now, therapeutic antibodies are used today for the treatment of a number of diseases, in particular for cancer and immune disorders. So cancers of the breast, bowel, head, neck, bone, blood, immune disorders ranging from PNH, transplantation rejection, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoporosis, Crohn's disease, psoriasis, ankylosing spondylitis, asthma, and multiple sclerosis, and other things like acute macular degeneration, which I wasn't sure what it was, whether it was an immune disorder or not, and one antibody against respiratory syncytial virus. In the next slide, I've listed the worldwide sales in 2010 of the top 10 selling pharmaceuticals. So that's everything, small molecules, biologics. And each one of these items has sales of more than $5 billion per year. Now, at numbers 1 and 3, we see, and actually also at 9, we see traditional pharmaceutical company drugs. They're essentially chemicals. Two of them are statins, that's Lipitor and Crestor. At number 2, I've shoved all the insulins. All the other slots are taken by antibodies. And it's predicted that they'll also take over the top 3 slots by 2014. So this is quite clearly a revolution, or perhaps more accurately, a coup d'etat, where the traditional pharmaceutical leaders are taken out and being shot. So if we look at antibodies, they're part of our natural defense against virus and bacteria, and are normally raised by encounter with a foreign antigen in the course of a disease. So a whole slew of antibodies are generally made against the most exposed part of the pathogen. They're actually huge molecules compared to traditional drugs. The antibody has got a molecular weight of 150,000 compared to about 500 for a typical pharmaceutical. They consist of 4 polypeptide chains. This is actually a bit... so you can see it here. 4 polypeptide chains, that's 2 heavy chains, which I've marked in red, and 2 light chains in white. And those come together in the IgG molecule to form a Y shape. At the tips of the Y are the variable domains, this region here. And these provide a scaffold, so it's a different kind of depiction, provide a scaffold for carrying loops of varying sequences and sizes that bind the antigen. By binding to the antibody can block its actions. For example, it can prevent viruses or toxins of tetanus, diphtheria, and cholera locking onto human cells and thereby giving protection. In addition, antibodies can act as a flag to the immune system, directing killing activities onto the pathogen. So, for example, if we look at the number of cells involved in antibody-mediated responses, it turns out that neutrophils, macrophages, and NK cells can all mediate killing through antibodies. And they do this by a whole variety of death mechanisms, chucking at them reactive superoxides, peroxides, perforins — these are molecules that punch holes in membranes — and also, of course, by phagocytosis, which is sort of eating them up. Now, as long ago as the 1890s, clinicians wondered if antibodies might also be used for treating cancer. And it took some advances and nearly 100 years, but the answer is yes. This shows the action of a modern antibody, that's Campath or alemtuzumab, which was made in Cambridge, directed against human T and B cells, and it was used to treat a patient with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So this is the untreated patient, and this is after 30 days' worth of treatment. And in fact, at the end of 30 days, this actually is the 10-day line here, at the end of 30 days, the tumour was largely destroyed, a tumour of several kilograms. That was in 1988. Another antibody, or a series of other antibodies, I've marked here those which are market leaders, can be used in a variety of different diseases. For example, if we look at trastuzumab, otherwise known as Herceptin, that attacks and kills breast cancer cells, which overexpress the HER2 receptor. But the blocking activity of antibodies can also be used to kill cancer cells more indirectly. For example, the other market leader, a bit light here, is Avastin, which binds to the molecule VEGF that creates new blood supplies around the tumour and so blocks the supply of nutrients needed by the tumour. So as well as cancer, antibodies can also be used for treatment of autoimmune disease. So, for example, Prolia, otherwise known as denosumab, blocks the action of RANK ligand and shifts the balance between osteoclasts and osteoblasts and thereby protects against osteoporosis. Anti-TNF antibodies, such as Humira, can block the action of mediators of rheumatoid arthritis, such as TNF. And the anti-TNFs have proved to be spectacularly successful and have transformed the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. So, in fact, three of the top 10 selling antibodies on that list were against TNF, with combined sales of more than $19 billion. So at this point, it's worth trying to bring out the differences between antibodies and traditional chemical pharmaceuticals. So what I've marked here in green are some of the advantages, and in red the disadvantages of these respective classes. Now, several of the properties follow from the size of the antibody. So I pointed out antibodies are big molecules. They can engage over a large contact area with their target antigen, so there are many interactions, and that means they can tend to have a much higher binding affinity to their target and a greater binding specificity. By contrast, chemicals being much smaller and capable of many fewer interactions and quite often hydrophobic lead to weaker binding and usually lower specificity. Often as well, the small chemicals will bind to other targets, particularly to hydrophobic pockets in molecules that you actually weren't aware that they were going to do that to. So you can get unexpected toxicities that might emerge only at a late stage in a clinical trial. So actually, antibodies are much more predictable in that respect. You don't normally get off-target toxicities occurring at a late stage when you've spent lots of money. Similarly, the large size of antibodies readily blocks the interactions between proteins. So if we think we're trying to stop a protein ligand binding to its receptor, these are large things. And antibodies large as well, and it can get in the way. Small chemicals tend to get squeezed out. Antibodies are also too large to be cleared by filtration of the blood through the kidneys, so they have a long serum half-life, in fact, up to a month. And that can allow dosing intervals of several weeks. In fact, more recently, the antibody Prolia, denosumab, is given every 6 months. That's actually quite interesting, because it only has a half-life of about a month. But because the amount of RANK ligand is relatively small, they can put a large excess of antibody in, and in fact it will go through several half-lives and still be able to neutralize the small amount of the ligand. Now that starts to become very interesting if you could make antibodies with very long dosing schedules. So rather than a pill every day, you could take an antibody every 6 months or perhaps even every year. So by contrast, the small molecules are cleared more rapidly from the blood, they're cleared through the kidney, and they have to be taken as a pill every day. And finally, as I've already mentioned, as well as having all these other desirable features, so in this green area here, they have all these built-in killing mechanisms which can recruit all kinds of cells. So far they seem to have all the advantages, and you might ask, if they're so clever, why have they only recently come to our attention? And it's because they've got some serious disadvantages. And in particular, they're digested in the gut, so they have to be given by injection. They struggle to get to targets outside the blood vessels or to targets inside cells. And they can be immunogenic. And that was one of the biggest problems. So modern-grade pharmaceutical antibodies had to be developed from primitive origins. They started off as animal antibodies, and they had to be evolved to a human form. And this is the equivalent in the antibody evolutionary stakes. We start off with some animal antibodies, which I've marked in red, and we work our way up through a series of hybrid forms going up to the fully human antibody. But the first step in the ascent of the antibody was actually the rodent monoclonal antibody. In 1975, Milstein and Koehler at the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology were trying to understand a fundamental question. How repeated immunization, for example, as with vaccine boosters, can lead to antiserum that binds more tightly to the target and can give greater protection. It was not clear whether this was due to the appearance of new antibodies or to subtle changes in existing antibodies. And they wanted to dissect the problem was they were just dealing with this total pool of antibodies, and they wanted to dissect the antibody response to a given antigen into its component antibodies and to study the individual components. They had the idea of isolating the antibody-producing cells from the spleen of a mouse and tried to grow them up, but the cells died in culture. So they decided to fuse them with the immortal cells of a cell line, and they made a hybrid cell, or hybridoma, which when cultured was immortal, and it produced a single species of antibody, which was the monoclonal antibody. Now, as well as actually helping them in their research, they realized immediately this could have great practical benefit and could allow them to make monoclonal antibodies against rare antigens such as cancer markers. Imagine you want to make an antibody against a human tumor. You inject human material into a mouse, you get a whole slew of antibodies. The vast majority will be against normal cells. There'll only be a few of them that are very tumor-specific. Anyway, other researchers very quickly showed that these monoclonal antibodies could kill tumor cells if you got the right antigen. And they were put into patients, and it did depend somewhat how well the mouse antibody was able to flag in the human effector mechanisms, the human killing mechanisms. But the problem was, after a week or so, the mouse antibodies provoked human anti-mouse antibodies. They saw these mouse antibodies as foreign, and that blocked their activity. And it was clear that human antibodies were needed. Now, a partial solution came from outside the field of immunology. It came from the field of protein engineering. It's a branch of recombinant DNA technology in which proteins are tailored by manipulating their genes. In 1983, Kabili in Genentech in California, this was the early days of Genentech, proposed in a patent the idea of making human-mouse chimeric antibodies, taking the genes which carry the antigen binding activity from the hybridoma and pasting these onto the body of a human antibody. So in fact, the genes are arranged in a modular way, as you can see on the left there, which simplifies the cutting and pasting. But actually, this was only a really paper patent. they hadn't done it, but they'd put some instructions in how one might do it. In fact, the first people to do it were researchers from Stanford University. But these antibodies were two-thirds human. They have proved subsequently to be less immunogenic than the mouse antibodies in patients, and they also flagged up all the human killing mechanisms. So that was pretty good. Now, protein engineering also offered another solution. At that stage, I was working on enzymes, so we're talking about the early 80s, and I was using protein engineering to understand the mechanisms of catalysis. I wondered if it was possible to build novel enzymes by engineering a universal scaffold, and my eye focused on the antibody scaffold, this region here with the loops. It could quite clearly accommodate a wide variety of loops, and maybe we could build catalytic activities into those loops and engineer novel catalysts. But I wasn't sure whether changes in the loops might distort the scaffold, so I set up a control experiment. I took the loops from one antibody to another antibody to see what would happen to the antigen binding activity. In particular, I transplanted the loops from a mouse antibody to a human antibody. So like that, and I found the new antibody retained the binding activity of the original mouse hybridoma. And that these antibodies were now 95% human. And in fact, the differences occurred in regions that differ between human antibodies anyway. Now, I then realized that turning mouse antibodies into human was more important than turning antibodies into enzymes. And I turned myself from an enzymologist into an immunologist and from basic research into application. Now, freshly arrived in this field of antibodies, I wasn't sure about all this immunology stuff. I thought the immune system might be able to sniff out the presence of mouse in those antibodies, despite the spin we were putting on it. I thought maybe we could use protein engineering to create genuine human therapeutic antibodies. That was a bit crazy. The idea involved creating a huge repertoire of different antibodies by genetic engineering and then somehow finding the ones that bound the target antigen. So it's a bit like the master thief who can open any lock if he has a large enough bunch of keys. Now, to be useful, we knew we'd have to create and interrogate a repertoire of about more than 100 million antibodies. I could actually see how to create the repertoire, really by combining 10,000 heavy chains and 10,000 light chains, and the combinatorial would give you 10 to the 8. And we could get those from populations of human lymphocytes. It was less clear how to find the antibodies that bound to the antigen, so it's a bit like finding a needle in a haystack. 1 in 10 to the 8, how would one find it? And I had the idea of cloning antibodies for display into some kind of living package. Take a replicable package. It could be a cell or a bacterium or a yeast or a virus. Then the idea would be you capture the binders on the target antigen, then you'd grow up the whatever the living package was and be able to fish out the antibody from it. It wasn't clear at that stage what package would work. At the same time, in the Laboratory of Molecular Biology, there was a collaboration developing between two scientists. That's Michael Neuberg and Mariana Brueggemann, Mariana at the AFRC. And they had the idea of not engineering the antibody exactly, but engineering the mouse. And so they put human antibody genes into a mouse and trying to get the mouse to make the human antibodies. Again, a huge feat of technology. So I'm now going to, I've explained the technology, and I'm going to jump ahead a few years, and I'll tell you that technology worked. We were able to complete the evolutionary tree in creating these therapeutic antibodies. You might wonder how well they worked, and I think it's useful then to look at the products that have emerged from them. And I've marked these according to class. So what we have here are the, I can't see anything on the chimeric class on the top left, the humanized class at the bottom, and the human class here, and this is the timeline. So what you can see is the chimerics and the humanized antibodies were early in the scheme. Chimerics have faded out, and the human antibodies are taking off. So actually, all of these technologies worked and delivered products. So now I'd like to turn to the issue of translation and the UK contribution to the field. So I put some little flags on the technology here. And if we look at the evolution of these antibodies, if we look at the rodent antibodies, the humanized and the human, there's actually been a major UK contribution. The other contribution is from the United States. If we look at the products, though, so I've marked little flags here on the products you saw. And in fact, there are seven products with flags that I've put on them. And the criterion for a flag is whether there was, in my view, a significant UK input in their development. That's probably contentious, but what you can see here is that from the 29 or so products that we have here, only seven had a significant UK input. So the technological lead didn't actually carry through to the development of antibody products, but it is there. So to understand a little bit more about this, I thought it would be a good idea to explain how the technology transfer worked for monoclonal antibodies, which are not exactly on this, humanized antibodies and human antibodies. And I put those because I was around at the time, and so I know the details, probably more details than are public. So what I've done here is to produce a list which is sort of features you might look for in trying to translate a product. And this would apply not just to antibodies, but to other things. And I dare say a professional bureaucrat were to get going, that list would be a lot longer than that. But it's the things that I thought were relevant in this case and would be fairly general. So the issues would be, was a patent taken? If so, was it a single patent required to operate the technology, or was it multiple patents? Were patents taken on improvements? There's the issue of licensing strategy. Was it exclusively licensed to a single party? Was it licensed non-exclusively or more broadly? Did the license include rights to future intellectual property? If we look at commercial exploitation, were there research collaborations with commercial partners? Did the research group contribute to product development? What kind of companies, startup, biotech, or pharma, were key to successful commercialization? If we look at the bottom, at outcomes, did the technology feed back into the research base? Did it have a clinical impact? What was the impact for the UK, companies, or jobs? What royalties were received, and what were the worldwide sales per annum? So let's look quickly at the translational process, putting little crosses in for mouse monoclonal antibodies. If we look at the patent side, there were no patents filed. Now, this was in the day of the National Research and Development Corporation, a monopoly power, and they were responsible for commercializing all research emerging from the research councils, and they didn't file a patent even though they were alerted. And in fact, here's an excerpt of their favorite letter from their famous letter from the MRC, which I always like to produce, to bash them. It's certainly difficult for us to identify any immediate practical applications which could be pursued as a commercial venture, and it's not immediately obvious what patentable features are at present disclosed in the Nature paper. Now, funny thing about that was the BBC had earlier actually broadcast it and were very excited about it, so it went out to the Empire, or the ex-Empire, on the World Service, saying just how wonderful an invention this was and all the possibilities that would emerge from it. So no patents were filed. The technology was taken up widely in research laboratories. It was also taken up widely in companies, perhaps because there were no patents filed. Translation wasn't an issue. It just translated itself. And attempts were made to capture some of the value for the UK. I think James Gowans, the secretary of the MRC, was repeatedly handbagged by Mrs. Thatcher on the matter. And in the end, the National Enterprise Board set up Celtec, which was the UK's first biotech company. Now, in fact, what the MRC did was to, which I've just marked here, was to assign future rights on the IP of antibodies. So they'd missed out on the first wave of patents, but what they could do is to say anything arising in this area in the MRC, you can have. So there was an exclusive arrangement reached. And despite that, or perhaps because of that, the engagement of MRC scientists under the COSH was a bit limited, and Celltech commercialized some blood group reagents, and some of the scientists from the Laboratory of Molecular Biology acts as consultants, in particular Milstein. And I think the important thing that happened as a result of that interaction was that Celltech set up research on making recombinant antibodies. So in fact, Celltech was in a good position for the field that started to develop. One of the other companies that picked up monoclonal antibodies, which is actually not often realized very early on, was a subsidiary of Unilever called Unipath. And they developed the Clear Blue pregnancy testing kit in the mid-1980s. And it's probably the most advanced consumer diagnostic test I think ever developed. Very, very impressive. About 50 patents just on the box. The biggest impact of antibodies has in fact been, of monoclonal antibodies, it hasn't really been in therapy, it's been in that research and diagnostic area. But the market is still quite big, estimated about $10 billion per year. So now I'd like to look at the translation of the technology for making humanized antibodies. So we filed a patent in 1986 on a model antibody. And in fact, the first step in translation was nothing to do with companies. It was an academic collaboration between my group and that of Herman Waldman in the Cambridge Department of Pathology. And in 1988, we humanized a rat antibody against white cells, the Campath antibody I showed you earlier, and used it to destroy a large mass of tumor. Now, that demonstration had a dramatic effect in companies. People thought, right, this is really getting somewhere. And various biotech companies wanted to learn the technology and take out a license to it. But the patent position was complicated. So this is the patent landscape in the late 1980s. By virtue of being in there early, Celltech had started work on making recombinant antibodies, and in fact Genentech also did. And they had both filed patents. The claims of the Celltech patent application and later the Genentech application were directed towards what seems to me to be blindingly obvious, which is the co-expression of an antibody heavy on light chain in the same cell. As you say, that's an antibody, isn't it? So, and they're normally produced in a cell, but that was held to be inventive. Now, at that stage, we didn't know whether it would grant, but the worrying thing was if it did grant, the patents would dominate the entire field of chimeric, humanized, and anything else coming beyond that. We didn't actually know. We knew that Celltech and Genentech had filed both patents, but we didn't actually know which one of them would prevail. So there were patents at that stage from Genentech and Celltech, which rather potentially blocked the whole field. However, the good news was that Genentech controlled access to the chimeric antibody format. So Celltech it couldn't follow that format, so it had to get a license from the MRC to make humanized antibodies. And they were particularly interested in making antibodies against TNF, which has actually turned out to be a great target, but for the wrong reasons. They were going to use it for treatment of septic shock. Now, the MRC was actually quite correctly more interested in seeing its technology widely applied. We knew there were many monoclonal antibodies out there that, one could use if you could humanize them. And we had the idea of offering a non-exclusive license with low upfront and low royalties. Now, that strategy had been developed by Stanford with the Cohen-Boyer model for licensing recombinant DNA. So we knew there was some history of models of that sort working. The problem was that anyone the MRC licensed, suppose the MRC licensed Celltech and they licensed everybody else to make humanized antibodies, the companies would simply find themselves stymied at this point here, where there were these two patents on the original the heavy and light chains. So actually, the MRC used its position with Celtec to open up the whole field, and they reached a historic agreement with Celtec, which I think is as important as anything else in helping this field move forward. What happened was they agreed to give a license to Celtec for humanized antibodies and to give it an exclusive license for its favorite target, TNF. But in return, they had to agree that the MRC could license their patent to MRC licensees wanting to make humanized antibodies. So the MRC was able to offer a package of both licenses to companies that it wanted to do, which it did so on a non-exclusive basis. And the effect was that, in fact, this probably explains in good measure why the biggest class of recombinant of therapeutic antibodies is humanized antibodies. Because effectively, commercially, we had the science and we got the licensing strategy correct. Now, that effect was immediate. The MRC was approached for licenses by loads of companies. In the end, we licensed more than 40 of them, including startups, biotech, pharmaceutical companies. Actually, what's most surprising is that, Genentech took out a license and used the technology and didn't bother making chimeric antibodies. Internally, they decided to make humanized antibodies because I guess they'd been persuaded by our spin about immunogenicity. Wellcome Biotech actually picked up the development of the Campath antibody, and the MRC Collaborative Center, which was a center had been set up by the MRC to spin off MRC work, and in fact a precursor of MRC technology today, helped companies develop humanized antibodies as products. Now, recently, there's actually two of those antibodies that came from the humanizing by the MRC Collaborative Center, which have led to important pharmaceuticals. So Actemra, their collaboration with Chugai, that's used to treat rheumatoid arthritis, and another program with Elan originally for Tysabri, which is used for treating multiple sclerosis and Crohn's disease. Now, Wellcome Biotech, who'd been working with a Campath antibody, dropped it because it didn't meet their commercial requirements, but it was actually picked up by a whole succession of other companies and was approved for the treatment of chronic lymphocytic leukemia and recently is in the process of getting marketing approval for multiple sclerosis. So the impact of that technology has been huge. The humanized antibodies, I mentioned already, the biggest class and used to treat a wide range of diseases. The combined sales of humanized antibodies are probably in the order of about $20 billion per year. And this has brought back more than $500 million in royalties back to the MRC. I think the saddest aspect of it was the failure of UK industry, other than Celtec, to try to capitalize on this technology. We had no interest from the major UK pharmas. So finally, I shall come to human antibodies. And this was very different again. By 89, we were taking this antibody repertoire approach. We had shown how to make the antibody repertoires of huge size from populations of lymphocytes, and we filed loads of patents. But we hadn't shown how to display them in a replicable package and select the binders. And at that point, we discovered the Scripps Research Institute had come up with the same idea and had teamed up with a local San Diego company called Stratagene. And their team was growing bigger and bigger. And we needed to move very fast. The MRC didn't have any space available then, although they did come good later, and I'll get to that. So I turned to UK industry to help, Celtec, Wellcome, and UniPath, but it must have all seemed very blue skies. So you go along and say, we have millions of antibodies, and then we find out the one we want. And they say, well, that's very interesting. Have you done it? No, but we're going to do it. We should sort it out. How are you going to do it? Well, you know, some living organism, some package. But don't worry, we'll sort it. So that is not persuasive to the companies like that. And in fact, they had another question, which is, well, what's so wrong with the humanized antibodies? You were here a year ago telling us these humanized antibodies were the best thing since sliced bread. So we lost. We had no credibility with them. But I asked the MRC for permission to help me set up, since no other current industry would do it. I wondered if we should set up our own company. So if the Scripps had got a company, then that and no one would work with us, then maybe we just need to set one up ourselves. And we were very lucky that Aaron Klug, who was the director of the LMB, and Di Reese, who was secretary of the MRC, said, okay, see if you can do it. Now, as I discovered that starting a company, you need more than the core science, the patents, and the license strategy. You need a business plan and management and lots of money. And in fact, it's got sorted out quite quickly. Basically, from personal contacts, management appeared in the form of David Chiswell, an antibody engineer from Amersham International, who was about to be made redundant. I managed to get money from a speculative Australian biotech company called PepTech. PepTech was actually into horses. It was into fertility in horses. And I think many of the people in it were betting people, and they thought, yeah, it's a good bet, let's try it. Put the money on this horse. So we set up a research collaboration between the MRC and the company to share the core science and the intellectual property. And our business plan was to work with industrial partners and make enough money to fund our own products. Now, you know, that seemed very realistic at the time. I realize now it was not. But anyway, Cambridge Antibody Technology was born. It was all done in 3 months. No legal documents, a few handshakes all round. And in a few months, we'd got a company researcher placed in our labs who hit the jackpot, found antibodies could be displayed on a bacterial virus, and we now had a means of interrogating our vast repertoires. And it gave us the edge over the scripts. Now, in the meantime, the MRC, I said, came good because they'd applied for extra funding from the government to set up an interdisciplinary research center on protein engineering. And I was appointed as a deputy director, and that gave me extra space and resources to expand my group from 6 to 26. So we worked on the technology, our patents, the research becoming really very interactive with Cambridge Antibody Technology. But CAT focused on developing products and commercial deals. We focused on the underlying research. One of our first partners was BASF, and they'd wanted to make a humanized antibody against TNF, had been to the MRC and discovered that the MRC had licensed the technology exclusively to Celltech. So they came to Cambridge Antibody, and we said, well, yeah, maybe we can do this for you with our vast repertoires, and have you done it before? No, but you know, we'll sort it. Anyway, they didn't have a choice, so they came to us, and our collaboration actually culminated in Humira, which is a blockbuster human antibody now and is predicted to be the world's top-selling pharmaceutical by 2014. So actually, I'm really delighted we had that exclusive deal with Celltech, because, in fact, otherwise we wouldn't have got that commercial arrangement with CAT. Now, although the strategy for human antibodies was very different from that with humanized antibodies, it was also successful, and there were two human antibodies developed by CAT. There was Humira, which is for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis, and Benlysta for treatment of systemic lupus erythematosus, and they're on the market. And the royalties to the MRC from that portfolio come to about $250 million. Now, CAT's no more. It paid the price of success and was acquired by AstraZeneca for more than $1 billion. And it continues in Cambridge with 300 employees managed by MedImmune, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of AstraZeneca. GSK also actually profited from CAT because they now market Benlysta with Human Genome Sciences, and I think helped them develop that in the late-stage clinical trials. So although the UK large pharmaceutical companies had shown no interest in the technology at the beginning, they've come to it and they're using it to build their product pipelines. So finally, I'd just like to make a few observations. About translation. This work actually emerged from Blue Sky's curiosity-driven research. We never really we were just given money and just told to get on and do what we thought was important, and we did. It was translated in completely different ways. As I said, with hybridomes, no patent filed. The technology translated itself, and the impact was for research and diagnostics. The the National Enterprise Board set up Celtec as the first UK first biotech company, and that turned out to be very important for later. With humanized antibodies, the patents were filed, the technology was widely licensed as a package, leading to a large class of therapeutic antibodies. In the UK, Celtec used the technology, leading to the product Cimzia, which is an anti-TNF antibody. They finally got there. And the MRC used its collaborative center to undertake contracts, developing a couple of the current products. With human antibodies, patents were filed and the technology licensed exclusively to a startup company, Cambridge Antibody, which worked with multiple industrial partners to develop human antibodies, which again led to products. The other thing I want to point out is there are quite long timelines with this. From, if we think about the timeline from the first chimeric antibody to its approval, it's 10 years. The same with the first humanized and the humanizing technology. I think overall that the biggest value for the UK has really emerged from working with industry partners. Now, whether that was through the MRC Collaborative Centre or through the startup company Cambridge Antibody, in both cases, in a way, the model was similar. We were working with industry. They were paying most of the costs. And again, it's worth pointing out that translation was done without VCs or interactions with UK large pharma. I think without VCs was good. I think that the lack of interaction with large pharma was a disappointment, because I think we could have captured more of that UK value if they'd taken more interest earlier. And I suspect that's got to do with their perception of what a pharmaceutical is, and they were, in a way, too well educated. And they recognize just chemicals as being important. I think, again, I've pointed out that as well as the public money used to generate the research, public money was actually also used in its translation. So if you look at Celtec being set up by the National Enterprise Board, you look at the setting up of the Collaborative Center by the MRC. And in fact, if you look at CAT, it was also subsidized, because effectively we undertook a research program paid for by the government in the Center for Protein Engineering, on which Cambridge Antibody had exclusive rights. So all of those things had a level of subsidy, which frankly I don't think would have been possible to do if we hadn't had that. But I suspect the same is true in the States with the various government grants and programs that they can get. I think until we can change the scale of risks to one in which the private sector is willing to accept, I think we have to contribute some kind of public funding. What isn't on the slide is a kind of, in a way, an obvious point that particularly if you look at the humanized antibodies, that the decisions on translation are actually highly commercial decisions. So that's looking at that patent strategy. Was a very commercial decision. And we were very lucky. At those days, we didn't really have a functioning MRC technology. The MRC Collaborative Center was rather apart. Those decisions were dealt with by Di Rees, who was the secretary of the Medical Research Council, and he'd had come from industry, so he had quite a high-powered academic and yet someone who knew how industry worked. And I think that he was sort of instrumental we all contributed to shaping the policy that ended up driving the humanized antibodies into the arms of many companies. I think it's worth saying that if you look at this the translational dimension, we can see that it's highly commercial, and you can also see the desirability of apparent public funding. It sort of made me wonder, really, whether the average technology transfer organization is kind of up to it. I think we were quite lucky in the MRC. We just happened to have those things around, but I think we were very lucky to get away with it. And therefore, I'd been wondering whether I just leave this floating as to whether a better model for taking discoveries forward would be kind of technology exploitation companies, which could be jointly funded by government and private industry. In fact, the government funding might correspond to massive tax breaks to the investors. I mean, that's another way of trying to do it. And I think that way one could have a development of the very highly specialized companies and commercially astute companies that are probably required for development of this area. And certainly that's the, from looking at all the evidence that I've got and my own feelings about it, you know, I think that would be the way forward I would see for formulating a technology strategy or translational strategy. So with that, I thank you for your attention.